DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. On today's programme, it's Inside Europe's Olympics special, but has France's political crisis dampened the mood in Paris?
We will receive the entire world, and it would have been better to have a normal government, not a government whose ministers are just resigning.
How climate change is hurting some athletes' hopes of gold. The sight of the Olympic flame gets Parisians fired up. And belonging through sport, how the Games are helping refugee athletes to rebuild their lives.
I watched my first Olympic when I was 4 years old. It was impossible for me when I was in Iran, and I gave up this dream, you know.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme. The Olympic flame being lit at the Palais de Versailles near Paris on Wednesday, ahead of the moment France has been waiting nearly 7 years for, the opening of the 2024 Olympic Games. Over the next 2 weeks, more than 10,700 athletes from over 200 countries will compete in 32 sports, including four new ones, like breakdancing. The Games have somewhat been overshadowed by the country's political crisis after President Emmanuel Macron called a snap legislative election last month when his political bloc was trounced by the far right in the vote for the European Parliament. The legislative election handed an alliance of leftist parties the most seats in Parliament, but no overall majority, and Macron was severely weakened. So will France's political deadlock spoil the Olympics party? To begin our first half special on the Games, I spoke to Pascal Boniface, founding director of the French Institute for International and Strategic Affairs.
There is no real impact on the Olympics because, in fact, we have still the same minister of interior, same minister of sports. They resign and still they are there. So it's very strange on a constitutional point of view, but for the daily affair, there is no difference. We are still in crisis because there is no new government, but the current government is riding the usual affairs.
So do you think it was a mistake for Macron to call the snap election in France just before the Olympics?
It has been a mistake in his own interest because he has less deputies, less congressmen than before the election. So it's not really a success. And secondly, we will receive the entire world, and it would have been better to have no political fights and the same government, a normal government. In fact, there is no real impact on the Olympic Games, but he had an impact on the image of France.
Now, Macron has said he's not going to name a new prime minister until after the Olympics is over. Do you think there's going to be any movement in this crisis before the Games end?
It's a $1 billion question. There is a lot of division between the Macron party and the others because you have three different political blocs. None of them is able to form a government alone, and they need to make coalition, but the coalition are not really easy to make. And so, therefore, it's very difficult to see the end of the tunnel.
So it could run on and on this then. Now, the Games have attracted a lot of international attention. Do you think they're going to be good for France's standing in the world?
It will depend on the result. If, for example, the opening ceremony is a success, it will be good for tourism and for the image of France. The Olympic Games won't change the French economy, but there is three different goals. First goal is to succeed and to have a lot of medals and preferably gold medals for our athletes. But there is two other things much more important, is legacy. What will be the legacy for France and for the image of France in the world? And what will be the legacy for the practice of sport in France? Is the new equipment will be useful? Is there is a lot of kids wanting to make more sports after the Olympic Games because they will dream seeing all the athletes during twice 2 weeks?
There's a bit of self-reflection in London over the 2012 Games and whether they really provided good value for money. Do you think there's going to be a pretty good Olympics dividend for France?
I think London was successful because it has changed the image of the city in the world, and you have much more tourism in London now than before 2012. Of course, this year won't be a good success for tourism in France because many people want to avoid Paris. In Paris this year, you will have as foreigners mostly people who want to attend to Olympic Games. The people who want to see Paris monuments will come next year. In terms of legacy, if we become a more sportive nation, it will be good. And also to have more acceptation of handicap. And the Paralympic Games are also very important in terms of societal aspects. For the first time, it will be an opening ceremony out of a stadium. And also the goal is to show in their best shape the most beautiful monuments of Paris.
And what an incredible sight they are. Thank you very much, Pascal Boniface, founding director of the French Institute for International and Strategic Affairs. Now, the final bill for the Olympics is expected to come in at around 10 billion euros. Athletes from around the world have also invested a great deal of time, money and determination to reach Paris and hopefully beat some records. But with the French capital expecting a mini heat wave during the Games, there are also concerns about what hotter weather will mean for performances and even the athletes' health and safety. A new report highlights the challenges and dangers that climate change poses to those vying for Olympic glory. Lars Bavanga reports.
The Olympic flame arriving on French soil back in May. The pride and excitement for the upcoming Games in Paris is palpable. What the organisers are not talking about is competitors vomiting and fainting at finishing lines, or athletes being afraid of dying during competitions. Yet that all happened at the last Olympics in Tokyo, according to a new report into the impact of climate change on sports.
In the report, we've seen athletes like Daniil Medvedev talking about the risks of athletes dying.
Nicola Barr works for the Australian organisation Frontrunners, who together with the British Association for Sustainable Sport have produced the Rings of Fire report. In it, several athletes give testimony about what hotter weather has meant to their performances and lives in general.
Yusuke Suzuki, who at the time was going to be a really top competitor for Japan representing her country at Tokyo, she couldn't compete after she sustained a heat stress injury. One of India's top triathletes, Pragnya Mohan, can no longer train in India because the heat conditions in India are so extreme.
Ridian Cowley now moves his way out into lane number three. Ladies and gentlemen, top 25 all time in world history at the moment on display. Ridian Cowley in the baby.
Australian race walker Ridian Cowley from Melbourne is one of the athletes who has contributed to the report. At last year's World Championships in Budapest, Ridian was beaten not by competitors, but the hot weather.
Yeah, I was competing in the 35-kilometre walk event. I didn't manage to get all the way through the event. I actually suffered heat stroke about 2 hours into the race. There was a person on the sideline that had a lovely photo of me lying face first on the ground.
Cowley and his support crew now increasingly focus on preparing for extreme heat and to be able to perform well, but most of all, to simply stay safe.
This year for me, that meant when I was in Melbourne, I in a heat chamber, sometimes 3 days a week for a bit over a month. Then I had a training camp in St. Moritz where I was in a sauna after a lot of training sessions. Right now I'm in Montpellier in southern France for a little bit more heat preparation.
The irony for international athletes, of course, is that they have to fly around the world to compete, increasing their own carbon footprint. What's more, the manufacturing of much of their equipment, running shoes in particular, contributes to copious amounts of CO2 emissions.
My name is Damien Hall. I've represented Great Britain at ultramarathon running. I'm a co-founder of the Green Runners and the author of a book called We Can't Run Away From This. The global trainer industry creates as many CO2e emissions per year as the United Kingdom.
What can professional athletes like you do about it? I mean, you're going to have to travel to certain events. All the people are now going to Paris to compete for the next 2.5 weeks. What can they do?
There was a study showing that athletes are the most influential people of our time, more than politicians or musicians, which is both sort of terrifying but also quite empowering. So I would encourage any athlete to speak up about the threat that's coming. And we've seen this report that's showing the danger to sports people.
So do amateur runners in my own neighbourhood think about the impact that their sport is having on the environment? Well, I'm off to meet some of the members of the Peak and Valley Runners who are getting ready for their Saturday morning run. Does it cross your mind the impact that your sport has on the climate?
Yeah, absolutely. My concern is, as we've had new products, new inventions, new shoes, you know, where that waste is going when runners don't use them anymore.
Do you know how many running tops you've got from races you've done?
I reckon 10, maybe a dozen.
And how many running pairs of running shoes?
Too many. I've probably got about 4 active pairs, and then another half a dozen that I've tried and not got on with.
But do you ever consider the climate impact of your sport?
Yeah, I do. I guess I balance it in my head with I don't buy lots of clothes for fashion or shoes for fashion. So where I do some good, I kind of allow myself to go a little bit excessive on the running side.
As the Olympic anthem rings out over Paris with the opening of the 33rd Summer Games, it might be worth dwelling on the foreword in the Rings of Fire report, written by Lord Sebastian Coe, President of World Athletics. We are in a race against time, and this is one race that we simply cannot afford to lose. Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
Now, the Olympics promise to be a spectacle to remember, from the opening ceremony held outside a stadium for the first time to the large number of events taking place with the sights of Paris as their backdrop. There'll be fencing in the Grand Palais, show jumping in the Gardens of Versailles, and judo by the Eiffel Tower, not forgetting the swimming in the Seine River. Despite the political manoeuvrings going on in France right now, Parisians still came out in force to see the Olympic flame pass through the streets. And John Laurenson went along.
I see in the morning paper that the Olympic flames coming through Paris. Figure out a time and place to see it in front of Père Lachaise Cemetery, seeing as you ask, and emerge from the metro of the same name into a happy crowd lining a street that's already closed to traffic. Good timing. First come the police, getting a few ironical but good-humoured cheers. A girl holds up her hand so they can high-five her as they walk by. It is, as this lady standing next to me attests, a happy affair despite the political drama and uncertainty in France at the moment.
I think if you look around you, everyone is quite happy to see the Olympic flame coming through. I think this is a really great way to get people together for a common cause. So that's going to be a really nice way to start the summer. A wonderful summer. And if you remember the London Olympics, everyone was complaining about what was going on in London and they're complaining about works. And it went really well.
There he goes.
Yep.
Sorry, I almost made you miss it there. Sorry.
But as luck would have it, the torchbearer, dressed in white, stops a few metres on to pass the flame on to the next torchbearer dressed in white, so we get a good look through the forest of smartphones held aloft for the photo. The organisers say millions have turned out to see the flame since it arrived by boat from Athens in Marseille in early May. But even the keenest will have found it difficult to concentrate on the build-up to the Games in the midst of the political drama that broke out shortly afterwards. As the crowd disperses, I get talking to this gentleman, who didn't come here for the flame but just happened to be passing. He says that with his unprovoked dissolution, President Macron has dampened the mood.
Il aurait pu la dissolution la faire après...
He could have dissolved Parliament after the Olympics.
sereinement, et là, c'est difficile dans la...
That would have allowed the French to enjoy this event with a measure of serenity.
Bah, y a le gouvernement.
Now it's difficult, with no government and a lot of doubt about the political future of France.
The following day is the one Paris mayor Anne Hidalgo chooses to finally swim in the Seine. To prove to any sceptics out there that the river that runs through Paris is ready for Olympic athletes to dive into. Shortly after which, I go up to Seine-Saint-Denis, the area northeast of Paris where most of the athletics is happening, to meet David Roizen. His job is to think about sport for a centre-left think tank called the Jean Jaurès Foundation. He believes the Olympics were part of Macron's dissolution calculation. He thinks the president reckoned people would be frightened away from voting for the extremes because that might jeopardise the games. It's actually difficult to say if the gamble paid off, but, says David Roizen, the dissolution did break the momentum.
For the last 2 months, where the torch was, there was a huge celebration. And it was starting to have good press. Ah, it could be a nice event, finally. And then happened the dissolution. With the dissolution, the Olympics disappear. It broke the wave. Finally, there was a starting wave in France about the Olympics. It broke it.
But to hazard another metaphor, the French political machine is a broken down car. And given that it's not going to go anywhere soon, perhaps people will be tempted to leave it by the side of the road, wander into a village, find a cafe with a television, and settle down in front of the 100 metres butterfly or something. After all, it's not every year you host the Olympics. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
And still to come on Inside Europe, meet the refugees in Germany and Austria battling for medals in Paris. Now, DW's website and social media pages have the latest news from across Europe. So that's DW.com or DW Europe on socials. I'm Nick Martin in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. And we wrap up our special Olympics first half with a story about the refugee team competing for glory in Paris, made up of 36 athletes from 11 different countries. The refugee team was created in 2016 to represent the world's displaced population of over 100 million people and has grown in size ever since. Natalie Carney met two of them in the Austrian capital Vienna and just outside the German city of Heidelberg.
The social media pages of 19-year-old Yekta Jamali Galeh are filled with inspirational quotes, yet many consider Yekta an inspiration herself. As a young woman growing up in Iran, life has not been easy. In her religiously conservative homeland, women have long had to abide by conservative norms, for instance, keeping their hair covered while in public and keeping a low profile. Females have long been pushed to the background. When one brave woman dared to push back by not wearing the traditional hijab headscarf, she lost her life. 22-year-old Masha Amini's death in 2022 inspired hundreds of thousands of brave women and men to take to the streets across Iran against her treatment by the country's infamous morality police and demanding more personal freedoms. At the time, Yetka was competing in the World Junior Weightlifting Championships in Greece.
With the pressures I went through, it was on me at that moment. So I jumped on a plane to Germany.
Yetka spoke to me from her new home in the German city of Leimen.
I had the feeling of fear, excitement, stress, all of that. But at that moment, I was thinking really strong mentally. I was really scared, but at that time, my fear wasn't so great. I'm really proud of myself.
When she arrived in Germany, alone at the age of 17, she was immediately put under the care of the Jungenamt, or the German Youth Welfare Office.
That's how I met my supervisor, who I call father. He helped me and introduced me to the German national team and their coach.
2 years since, Agnieszka has learnt the German language and is training 6 days a week with that coach, Almir Velagic, who says her success and that of many on the Olympic refugee team comes from the strength in their character.
The story that she has behind her, what she's achieved, if everyone were to put themselves in this situation at the age of 17, getting on a plane and not knowing where you will end up, you need a lot of courage, and that's what she's been through her whole life. People like that have something special in them that will help them to benefit more from regular life and in sport.
Yeka was introduced to weightlifting by her sister back in Iran and now boasts a personal best of 130 kilos. While both her and Almir admit there is still a long way to go before bringing home an Olympic medal, Yeka says she is absolutely dedicated to making the Paris Games the first in a lifetime of games and is even working to eventually raise the bar for Germany.
I don't think I can return to Iran, and now I've started a new life here. Everyone says the Olympics is their big goal and dream. Now maybe you can get a medal and so on. We have to see how the day goes. Every day, I want to be better than yesterday.
27-year-old Iranian-born Saman Soltani has always been a successful athlete. Like Yekta, Saman, who was also in Europe when protests broke out in her home country, felt she could not return. So while in Vienna, she sought asylum in Austria. Now, the medal-winning athlete is preparing to compete as a kayaker in the Olympic Games in Paris, a feat she thought impossible growing up in Iran.
From when I was a child, I loved to be in Olympic. I born in an Olympic year, and I watched my first Olympic when I was 4 years old. And then every 4 years, I watched Olympic, and I loved to be there. So it was impossible for me when I was in Iran, and I gave up this dream, you know.
Saman started swimming at the age of 5. While she grew to become a national champion in artistic swimming, this was not a sport for girls supported by the conservative Islamic Republic. She was then introduced to kayaking, in which she also won multiple medals for the national team. However, again, as a girl, she was unsure of where her career would lead until fateful events brought her to Vienna. She quickly found success as a kayaker in her host country and was then chosen for the Olympic refugee team in May 2024.
When I arrived in Austria, I saw that this dream can come true. It's for my family, for my friends, for everyone who helped me to stand up again.
According to media reports, about 30 Iranian athletes in recent years have defected from Iranian national teams and sought asylum in other countries due to alleged threats and Iran's policies towards women. Stories of courage and unrelenting determination encompasses each one of the Olympic refugee team's 36 athletes who represent 11 different countries and will compete in 12 different sports during the 17-day international sporting event. One of the quotes found on Yeka's social media page reads, "History will remember everything you do."
Even if people forget that person and what she said, history never forgets. And that's what's important.
Natalie Carney, DW, Vienna, Austria, and Leimen, Germany.
And over the next 2 weeks, we'll report on whether London's Olympics in 2012 were worth the 14 billion euro bill and whether Paris has done enough to make disabled athletes feel welcome. Remember to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts to hear all the big, interesting stories from across Europe. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Nick Martin in Germany. In the next half hour, we have a special treat from another one of DW's podcasts, Don't Drink the Milk. The podcast looks at the incredible stories that come out of everyday things. On this week's episode, Rachel Stewart looks at how passports came to be. They didn't even exist before World War I. And how geopolitical concerns are making millions of people chase travel and entry documents for other countries.
Chinese whispers.
Telefono senza fili.
Telephone. Kulaktan kulak.
Telepasta. Svarčeni telefon.
Telefona abe. Uche telefon.
Russian scam.
Don't drink the milk.
Hey, I'm Rachel Stewart, and this is Don't Drink the Milk, the podcast where we take you to different corners of Europe, tracing the unexpected backstories of everyday things. Things you've probably never stopped to question before. Like that little booklet we carry around to prove who we are. Sometimes it opens doors. Sometimes it means the door gets shut in our face. So I'm British, but I've been living in Germany for 7 years. And just before I made the move in 2016, this happened.
This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Yeah! That's definitely not how I reacted to the results. Luckily, Brexit didn't ruin my plans to move abroad. But it did make me question a few things about my passport and my identity. Did I feel more British or European? Should I try and get a German passport? And if I did, would I suddenly feel German? Our producer, Charlie, she's Australian. Her passport has a kangaroo on the front. No joke. And she's been digging into how and why the passport came to be in the first place. Because it didn't always exist, right?
I've been taken through a back door behind the counter at a big old library, down several flights of stairs into the belly of an archive. Here, in rows upon rows of green shelves, the United Nations stores hundreds of books. But that's not what I'm here for. I've come to meet someone who works in the archives, Hermine Diebold. And upstairs, she has something to show me.
It's a blue document. We can see that it has a number. It's a number 1131. We have the coat of arms and the name of the country.
Uruguay. This little blue document is one of the first ever versions of the passports we know today. It's about 100 years old. So, yeah, actually not that old.
Not so long, you know.
Hermine and I are not in Uruguay, though. We're sitting in a very high-ceilinged room at one of the old wooden desks on the top floor of the United Nations Library and Archives in Geneva, Switzerland. There's a reason this old passport lives here. Geneva used to be the home of the League of Nations, the predecessor of the United Nations. Around the time the League was founded, in the early 20th century, a lot of things were going on that helped pave the way for the passport. Empires crumbled, new nation states were born, people were no longer subjects of their rulers, but citizens of their nations. Plus, as things like air travel evolved, people were crossing borders way more often and way faster than before. Another big factor was war.
Because before 1914, before the First World War, no passport was needed to travel from one country to another.
But during the First World War, countries like Germany, France, the UK and Italy, they, perhaps unsurprisingly, started insisting that people from enemy countries needed official identification documents to enter their territories. Other so-called neutral states like Denmark, Spain and Switzerland, they were basically forced to follow suit. But when it came to the documents governments were handing out, everyone was kind of doing their own thing.
The border officials suddenly were confronted with a lot of different travel documents with different shapes, different size, and it was hard to know if the passport was authentic or not. So they really needed to find a solution.
And a solution they did find. The League of Nations gathered world leaders in 1920 in Paris at the succinctly named Conference on Passports, Custom Formalities and Through Tickets. And thusly, it was official. Passports everywhere should look a certain way and include the same kind of information.
The shape of a booklet measuring 15.2 5 centimeters for 10.5 centimeters, 32 pages. French has to be used in combination with another language. And the front cover of the document has to bear the country's name and the coat of arms.
But then Ermine tells me something odd, something I wasn't expecting. Ironically, the solution many world leaders were looking for wasn't a compulsory permanent passport.
The governments wanted to go back to the situation before the war. Yes, the idea was to abolish the passports.
A lot of world leaders preferred things the way they were before, when people could move around freely without carrying around this little booklet. It was also super unpopular with the public and with the press. People thought passports undermined their freedom, invaded their privacy, and were, like, kind of annoying.
The New York Times, October 24th, 1926. The passport nuisance. Must passports be retained as a permanent feature of travel? The system in vogue since the war is cumbersome, vexatious, and a drag on free intercourse between nations.
But
it was too late to go back to this freedom of movement. They realized it was too hard.
Sometimes barriers are easier to build than they are to take down. League of Nations members couldn't agree on what a world without border controls and without the passport would look like, on how they would uphold national security if people were allowed to get around freely like they did before. And so the passport was here to stay.
That's where the story began, but the passport has been on quite a journey since then.
And so have we. Quite unexpectedly, the story took us to a law firm, a hair salon, and a flour mill in North Macedonia. If you're not familiar with it, it's a small country of around 2 million people nestled in the Balkan Peninsula just north of Greece.
It sounds so random, but trust us, it ended up being a great backdrop for so many parts of this story.
Stay tuned for the scandal.
Yes, but first up, we wanted to know how the meaning of the passport has changed. What's its purpose and what does it symbolise?
I think it's who you are outside your own country more than what you are inside.
It's just a paper that help us to travel around, but that's all.
It is my identity. It's something that I am proud to have, to show that I'm Irish, because I'm very proud to be Irish.
Identity, not just in the ID sense, but in the who am I sense. One way to see the passport could be as a kind of membership card to a club. It can show that you have something in common with other members of the same club.
Like a shared history, a shared culture, maybe a shared language.
But sometimes, national identity isn't so clear-cut, like when different rulers come and go, or borders shift. Which brings us to the first reason we ended up in North Macedonia.
As far as I remember, I have at least one guest from Spain. Can I use you to help my point?
We've joined a walking tour in the capital city, Skopje. Our tour guide Zoran is quite the joker, and he's got a little anecdote for us. So, this one time.
I was in Barcelona. On a beautiful day, I end up in La Boqueria looking for refreshment, and I'm seeing those pots with fruit salads, and on the top of one, big capital letters, Macedonia.
In Spain, that's what they call this fruit salad, Macedonia. But something was wrong.
There was bananas and kiwis in the salad. This is not right. I turned around, went back to the market, asking for explanation. Why you call this one Macedonia? I am from Macedonia, trust me, no bananas. I love the girl. She said, oh, sir, don't worry. It's not about what type of fruit we put inside. As long as there is a nice mix of fruit, we're going to call it Macedonia. And I was like, yeah, that's what we are, a nice mix of everything.
This nice mix of everything country has been part of numerous empires and kingdoms over the past few thousand years. Roman, Byzantine, Bulgarian, Ottoman, Serbian. And each one of those rulers left a lasting mark on the culture. But there's another piece of the fruit salad we haven't even mentioned yet. Yugoslavia. The Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia existed from just after the Second World War until the early 1990s. It was made up of six constituent republics, including what is now North Macedonia. Ah, about the name.
Oh yes, we've been independent for only 32 years, but we already have two names and two flags.
The Republic of North Macedonia has technically only existed since 2019. When the country declared independence from Yugoslavia back in 1991, it was just called the Republic of Macedonia. But now they want to be part of the European Union. In order to settle a dispute with another EU country, Greece, they had to add North to their name. That's after already having redesigned their flag for similar reasons. After nearly 20 years of trying, they still haven't actually made it into the EU. But if they eventually do, this would surely mean another cultural shift and a new kind of passport. See what we meant by complicated national identity?
Okay, let's go to the drinking section.
Zoran leaves us with a few insider tips, like never drink your rakia as a shot, because that stuff is potent. I wish we'd learnt that earlier.
So, remember those people we heard from before, telling us what their passport means to them? Those were actually tourists we met in Skopje. And in most people's answers, there was a running theme.
Liberty.
A lot of freedom. A ticket to freedom.
To travel the world.
To travel, you know, where you want to go, to visit other countries. My passport, for me, is my freedom.
Which is kind of funny now that we know that people 100 years ago thought the opposite, that it was restricting their freedom.
Well, we should mention that all those people we just heard from, they all have pretty powerful passports.
Australian passport.
It's a Belgian passport.
We are from Brazil.
We're from Spain, but we live in Berlin.
We are from Austria.
Because not all passports are created equal.
Nuh-uh. Every year, passport indexes are released, ranking passports from first to last based on how many other countries can be visited visa-free by a holder of said passport. Or with visa on arrival, which is basically just a formality. So according to the current Global Passport Power Rank 2023, the number one spot is held by the United Arab Emirates.
Oh.
And at the bottom, that's Afghanistan. For some people, not having a passport is no big deal. They don't want one and they don't need one to go about their lives. But then there are people who are denied passports because they're not recognised as officially existing. They don't have citizenship, and without it, you can't get a passport.
I feel like I'm in prison.
That's Aisha. She lives in Germany, but she doesn't have a passport or citizenship to any country.
And she was born in Germany.
Yes, but she didn't get German citizenship at birth because her parents hadn't been in the country long enough. Her mother is from Iraq and her father was from Egypt. And Aisha kind of ended up falling through the cracks between those three countries.
And so why couldn't she get citizenship through one of her parents?
Well, her dad wasn't allowed to stay in Germany long term, so Aisha was registered under her mother's citizenship, Iraqi. But in some countries, women don't have the same rights as men when it comes to passing on citizenship to their children.
Ah, and Iraq is one of those countries.
Exactly. So even though in Germany Aisha is listed as Iraqi, she's not recognised as a citizen by Iraq.
And Egypt?
Her parents weren't legally married and they didn't live in Egypt when Aisha was born, and her father actually died in 2002, so she hasn't had any luck with the Egyptian authorities either.
Whew, this is so complicated.
Right? And she still can't get German citizenship. She's stuck in this bureaucratic limbo, but she's not giving up.
I'm like, no, I will fight for the fact to get the German citizenship because I think it's my right.
And this is about more than just not being able to go on a holiday, right?
Yeah, sure. She told me her mum is sick and being treated abroad and she can't visit her. She also couldn't go to her grandmother's funeral. But Aisha also does dream of travelling, just like all her friends do. So when I asked her where she'll go when she finally gets a passport, she broke out into this huge smile.
Oh, the list is long. I want to do a girls' trip, maybe to Turkey or something like this. I would like to visit India. I would like to visit Egypt because at the end, it's my father's hometown. So I just want to get to know it. And the same thing also about Iraq because of the fact that those are the home cities of my parents.
What about being without passports or citizenship? For a surprising number of people in the world, that's already a reality. They're stateless.
This often affects people who are discriminated against because of their ethnicity or religion. It can also be caused by changing national borders or contested nation states, like Taiwan. Today, there are an estimated 10 million stateless people around the world. And back in North Macedonia, we met someone who knows exactly how hard it is to be in this situation.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Nice to meet you in
person. Lovely to meet you. Yes, I'm Alexandra.
But don't worry, this story does end well. Because when we met Valentin, he'd just received his first ever official ID.
I'm really happy because for the first time I feel like I'm legally visible in the country, in the system, because for 21 years I didn't have any document.
Valentin's lawyer, Alexandra, is doing the translating here. She says that there are two main causes for statelessness in North Macedonia.
First one is historical and it is related to the dissolution of former Yugoslavia. Back then, certain number of people who originated from other countries that were part of Yugoslavia didn't register neither in Macedonian citizenship nor in the citizenship of the country they originated from.
There are some communities that are disproportionately affected, like poorer communities, people with less education, and socially marginalized groups, like the Roma population, which is a traditionally nomadic ethnic group in Eastern Europe. Statelessness then got passed on to their children and their grandchildren.
That is first cause of statelessness, and the other is administrative barriers in the birth registration procedure.
That's what happened in Valentin's case. Until now, he's been stateless all his life, simply because his parents didn't register his or his sibling's birth within the 42-day limit set in North Macedonia. His mother was Serbian and later abandoned them, and his father died. He never got a birth certificate, and so no citizenship. Without it, he struggled to access healthcare, he couldn't go to school.
I felt like I didn't exist. No one deserves to be left out from the system.
Valentin's 12-year legal battle for official recognition has paid off. And in recent years, North Macedonia has taken some important legal steps to fix these issues, to try and make sure everyone gets citizenship. So Alexandra is feeling pretty optimistic these days.
Now I feel that we have capacity, we have political will to solve these cases and to maybe to become first country in Europe that solved this problem. Why not?
How do you say congratulations?
Čestitke.
Čestitke.
Hvala, hvala.
Enjoy.
But you know what? Statelessness is nothing new. It emerged around the same time the passport did, post-World War I, alongside disappearing empires and new nation-states. And when I was in Geneva, Emin dug out something else from the archives to show me. It was another kind of passport.
So we have two of them. I have one is from a gentleman, a man, so it's just one sheet of paper. I don't know if you... I'm not sure you see it.
Ermin hands me a sheath of papers. I can make out a Russian name in neat calligraphy. She explains that after the First World War, more than 9 million people were displaced in Europe, including many refugees from Russia.
All these refugees had become stateless when the Bolsheviks issued a decree that revoked the citizenship of all Russian expatriates.
At that time, with world leaders basically having redrawn the European map, millions of people found themselves in countries that either didn't recognize their legal identity or weren't willing to give them one. They didn't have citizenship. They were stateless.
And Nansen had a very innovative idea.
Nansen was the High Commissioner for Refugees at the time, Fridtjof Nansen, a Norwegian guy. And his innovative idea was these special passports, which were actually more just like identity documents. Nearly 500,000 Nansen passports were issued in total before they were discontinued in 1942 and eventually replaced with international laws and conventions. But nowadays, there's this other side to citizenship too. It's more like a game, wheeling and dealing. Because it turns out, most countries do bend their own citizenship rules from time to time, if they see someone as valuable enough.
Like win us an Olympic medal kind of valuable. For example, take the case of US basketballer Becky Hammon. She accepted an offer to play for Russia in 2008. Despite having no Russian heritage, not speaking the language, and not even being a permanent resident, her citizenship was fast-tracked. She fulfilled her dream of competing at the Olympics, and Russia got a new star to help it to the bronze medal in Beijing.
But you know what else is seen as another real asset to governments? Money. If you have enough of it to spare, you can buy your way into some countries. It's called citizenship by investment,
aka the golden passport.
It's not cheap, though. It usually costs the equivalent of 500,000 to 1 million US dollars. Malta, Montenegro, Austria, Jordan, around 30 countries offer this kind of deal. One of the trailblazers back in 2006 was the Caribbean island nation of St. Kitts and Nevis. But who exactly is forking out for these golden passports?
People who have bad passports to begin with. People who want to be a lot more mobile than they are and who are constantly being hampered by the color of their passport. Right now, it's really not great to be Russian, you know, in the world.
So mostly people who have a low-ranking passport and plenty of cash.
Yes. Freedom isn't free, as the Americans like to say.
Meet Atusa Araxia Abrahamian. She's a journalist and the author of Cosmopolites, a book on the global market for citizenship. She's got four passports herself, although she didn't buy any of them.
I was born in Canada, sort of on purpose for the passport. So I have a Canadian passport. I have an Iranian passport because that's where my parents were born. I have a Swiss passport because I lived in Switzerland for 18 years, and after a certain amount of time, they gave it to me. And as of November, I am also a US citizen. It's complicated.
But guess which country is one of the most recent to start offering citizenship by investment? North Macedonia.
There are two main ways of buying your way into North Macedonia. You can either donate about 200,000 US dollars to a government fund, or you can invest just over $400,000 in a business in the country. It has to employ at least 10 people and be up and running for at least 1 year. So the country gets something out of it. But what the investor gets out of it is not so clear. The North Macedonian passport doesn't really get you very far. It's not an especially wealthy country, and many North Macedonians are actually trying their luck getting passports elsewhere.
If you are trying to sell a North Macedonia passport, you're not maybe pitching to the crème de la crème, you know? I think that if your instinct is, why would anyone want to be a citizen of this country? No offense to the country or its citizens, purely on the passport power, there might be something else going on.
Citizenship by investment has been linked to some shady deals and shady people around the world. It's also not just wealthy individuals who've made the most of this option, but entire countries too.
The UAE and the Comoro Islands were involved in a really weird passport scheme wherein the UAE bought passports in bulk from the Comoro Islands to document people in their country who are stateless, who UAE did not want to document with UAE passports.
Atusa discovered that in 2008, the United Arab Emirates decided to deal with the issue of their own stateless population by buying them passports to another country. They bought around 50,000 passports to a tiny island nation off the coast of East Africa. The Comoros government did get in trouble for doing this, and their president from back then is actually now in jail. And the country never even saw most of the money promised for this scheme. It's still a mystery as to whose pockets those hundreds of millions of dollars went into.
But as for the country that bought the passports...
No, the UAE has faced absolutely no repercussions. Barely a peep from the humanitarian world. Human Rights Watch, I think, put out a statement, but no, absolutely nothing.
The way Atusa sees it, the whole system of citizenship is outdated and unjust and basically needs a shake-up.
It's really a 20th century, even 19th, 20th century system, right, that was forged through massive wars and reacting to them. And I think it certainly seems like we need something new for the next century, but I'm not hopeful that we're going to come up with one. But this all boils down to the kind of same root cause, and that's that people are routinely discriminated against based on where they're coming from. You don't choose where you're born. You don't choose your nationality. You certainly don't choose your parents. And yet our whole architecture of the world is designed as if it is someone's fault that they're born in a certain place. And so if people are equal and free, we should start treating them like it. And I think a good place to start is passports and visa regimes and, you know, making migration a little freer.
We've driven 3 hours southwest of Skopje, almost to the Albanian border, to the little village of Befceni. It's a hilly town lined with traditional old stone houses with cute little balconies. One of the first things we see is a throwback to Yugoslavian times.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's very small. It's a nice car.
The Zastava 750 car, nicknamed the Feature. We ask around for some directions.
Just a minute. Okay, 600 meters.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Wonderful.
And set off uphill.
You can come with us.
Soon enough, we get to a stream. A stream with a story. In 1987, plans were made to redirect the water away from this community, apparently to provide water for houses being built by the rich elite. The Vefceni villagers rebelled, ending up in a violent standoff with police. This unusual example of resistance in communist Yugoslavia became known as the Vefceni Emergency. It lasted several months, but in the end, the villagers won, and their rebellious reputation was sealed. A few years later, Macedonia declared independence from Yugoslavia. But for the Vefceni locals, that wasn't enough. They held their own referendum and voted overwhelmingly to become an independent republic. It was never formally recognised, but they were eventually granted their own separate municipality. You can find many places like Vefceni all around the world. They're often referred to as micronations, communities that haven't officially broken away from their countries, but they use self-proclaimed independence to highlight something that they want or need, or simply to make a statement about their identity. Currency, constitutions, parliaments, even armies, and of course, passports, have all been used as symbols of independence. The idea of the Republic of Vefceni lost momentum over the years, until the early 2000s, when locals decided to revive it as a tourist gimmick. They printed their own currency, the Lichnik, which means beautiful in the local dialect, and they made their own passports.
We found the passport! So the Republic of Vefceni?
Yes.
So how much to buy?
150 dinars.
We'll get 2 passports and some money, please. We're getting a stamp.
Special.
Now we are the proud owners of Vefceni passports, emblazoned with the crest of the village and validated with a stamp. A little old man is sitting on a crumbly stone wall just outside the flour mill, which is powered by the stream. He explains that his family have worked here for 5 generations. But what does he think of tourists like us rocking up to buy a passport for €3?
Every time you come to Vefceni, it's happy.
We've got his approval.
So I guess we can stay.
Hvala. Prijatno. Ciao.
Rachel Stewart with that special edition of Don't Drink the Milk. The first season with 15 episodes is available on all podcast platforms, and season 2 is coming soon. Meanwhile, Inside Europe is getting more listeners than ever before, and if you'd like to help, leave us a review with your podcast provider as it helps other people to find us. Hope you enjoyed this week's show, which was produced by Helen Sini. And I'm Nick Martin. Thanks for listening. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Germany.